Welcome to Off Message. I'm Tim Alberta.
I think this is the question that a lot of folks have when they look at this next crop of Democratic politicians. Are there people you look at in whom you see that same flicker, that same raw political potential that could be harnessed in the way that you saw it in Obama all those years ago?
Look, that's unfair. You know, that's like saying, well, which of these horses reminds you of Secretariat?
We meet again. Thank you for listening, and thanks also for your continued feedback. Wendy loved last week's podcast with Chip Roy. She called it, quote, one of the best interviews I've ever heard, unquote, and said, quote, as a deep blue liberal, I think it's so important to have conversations like this with conservatives, unquote. Very perceptive, Wendy. Jimmy called the interview fake news, all caps, and said, quote, you must be looking hard to make him look bad, unquote. And Kyle wishes I would have pushed Roy further on what he means by let Texas be Texas, a phrase that suggests the state is culturally and politically monolithic. This week, I'm going to let Axelrod be Axelrod. That's David Axelrod, the former chief strategist behind Barack Obama's winning White House campaigns. These days, he's the director of the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics. He's also a senior political commentator for CNN and host of one of my favorite political podcasts, The Axe Files. Axelrod is never afraid to speak his mind, and with so much happening, the conclusion of the midterm elections, the onset of the 2020 campaign, and the intensifying rift inside the Democratic Party over how to defeat Donald Trump, I could think of no one better to break it all down.
I usually like to start these interviews on a light note, but given the events of the week, I just had to jump in here. We had this string of bomb scares directed at any number of figures, and obviously your former boss, President Obama, was one of them, and your current employer, CNN, another one. And I just wonder where you see the country now in terms of sort of the escalating polarization that we've been witnessing for many years now, but whether or not this represents sort of a new high or a new low, depending on how you view it, and where this takes us from here, and if there's any way to sort of bring the temperature down that you see in sight.
Well, what we've discovered is that there is a political capital in polarization. There's political capital in incitement. The president's a master at it. But there are also consequences to that. We're a country of 330 million people, and there are people out there whose violent inclinations are going to be activated by what they hear. So, you know, the question is whether the country itself demands something different. And, you know, when it becomes unprofitable to be out there inciting people in ways that are dangerous, when it becomes unprofitable to treat each other like enemies, to disqualify each other as people and as patriots and as Americans because we have different points of view, then things will change. Right now, unfortunately, politicians are being rewarded for that, principally the president. And, you know, I don't think that this is, I know it is unpopular to say this among some of my own friends, but, you know, escalation breeds escalation. And one of the things that troubles me, you know, I've been out there, Tim, saying that civility actually is a really important element of politics. We've had uncivil times before. We've had civil war, so it's not like this is new to American politics. We need to somehow find some common qualities in each other, common concerns that join us as Americans, and we have to stop this mad cycle. When I said what I've been very critical of the president because I think he has incited and encouraged violence through his rhetoric. People tweeted back at me and said, well, do you still think we should be civil? And I'm trying to understand what that means. Does that mean that if they send out bombs, we should send out bombs? That, to me, is a mad cycle that leads only to really dark places. So I'm hoping that we pull out of it. But that's going to be up to the American people if they start rejecting these kinds of tactics and they turn toward the light then it'll become unprofitable for politicians to follow that route, and we'll see a change in the tone of our politics.
And as you said, with escalation begetting escalation, obviously Hillary Clinton came under fire a couple of weeks ago for her comments about, you know, civility.
And I was critical of those. And, you know, I thought it was interesting. I think she rightly came out after she and President Clinton were the target of this attempted bombing and said, we need to come together as a country. But, you know, you can't say in 1 week be uncivil and in the next week say come together. We need to have a consistent commitment to that. And, you know, within the Democratic Party, I think there is a big debate about how to deal with Trump, because he has no boundaries. He's willing to do anything and say anything to promote his interests. It's a values-free politics. It's, you know, an amoral politics. So there is this body of thought that, you know, you have to fight fire with fire and so on. But I worry that that we'll all be consumed in the conflagration. So I think we need to be thoughtful, tough, and call him out. But we need to be thoughtful about how we do it. You know, I also was critical of the rousting of people right or left. I'm old enough to remember the debate over the Affordable Care Act when people were outside the Capitol and spitting on people, on legislators and so on. I thought that was bad. I don't think that personally confronting in people, particularly in private places — that was in public, but in private places, when they're with their families and so on, I don't see what's gained from that.
So here we are on the doorstep of the midterm elections, and a first-term president's first midterm historically is always a little bit unpredictable, always a little bit rocky, and you lived through one of those back in 2010.
Rocky would be an understatement. So I was completely drowned by the wave.
I was going to say
2010.
And when we talk about a hashtag blue wave, I think a great night for Democrats in this cycle would be picking up, you know, 35 to 40 seats. Republicans in 2010 pick up 63 House seats. Now that was a true wave, and I'm curious, David, thinking back to that, you knew that it was going to be a rough cycle. You and I have talked about this before.
Yes.
Given the dynamics of 2009, 2010.
I actually told him, I told President-elect Obama, we had a briefing in mid-December of 2000, I think it was December 16th. It was so searing, I'll never forget the date, at our transition office, where we got briefed on the state of the economy. And it wasn't really as pervasively known just how severe the crisis was at that moment. It really was in the next few weeks and months that the depths of it became completely clear. And I walked out of that briefing and I said, we are going to get our asses kicked in the midterms.
So you knew that it was going to be a rough night, probably. You knew you were probably going to lose the House. But how surprised were you, how surprised was the president at just how big that wave wound up being?
I mean, the depths of it were, I wouldn't say surprising, but depressing. You know, clearly the margin was — I always say we lost 63, but Roosevelt lost 78 in 1938. So we did better than Roosevelt.
There you go. It could always be worse. So this cycle, even though the fundamentals would seem to be in favor of the Democrats taking back the House, obviously the Senate map is so dramatically different
worse
from the House
map. Worse than a century.
Yeah. Yes. So Democrats, I think, have very
26 Democratic seats up, only 9 Republicans. And 10 of those seats in states that Donald Trump won. And we know that the recent history in this very polarized country is that states tend to follow their presidential preference. So the notion that all these Democrats were going to swim to shore or are, the current is very strong.
Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the prospects for Democrats to take back the House, it's been a bit of a roller coaster of a cycle. You've had moments in the cycle where Republicans were sure they were going to lose by a lot. And now over the last 3 or 4 weeks, the numbers have come back up and they feel like maybe there's an outside chance they hang on. I'm curious, from 30,000 feet, David, if you can fill in these blanks for me. The smartest thing that you have seen Democrats do in this cycle strategically is what?
I think the smartest thing has been to generally talk about issues that actually touch people's lives, like health care, which I think has been a really galvanic issue for a lot of candidates out there. You know, back in 2010, Republicans ran against the Affordable Care Act, and that was central to everything they did. Now they're trying to run toward at least the principle of it. And, you know, even though they don't have a plausible plan to protect people with pre-existing conditions, I think they now understand that the Affordable Care Act has spoke to real life concerns of people, and that healthcare is one of them. So I think doing that has been really effective. Obviously, there are certain things that happened organically that have something to do with the president, and that is the number of candidates who've run, the number of women who have been activated, the amount of money that's been raised, which is unlike anything that I've seen in my lifetime. Generally, you accept as a given that Republican candidates will outspend Democrat candidates by a substantial margin. And the outpouring of money, particularly in small donations over the internet, has been an offsetting factor. And now you see Democrats competitive or ahead in most of these races, and not just first-tier races.
And so, not just open seats. Right. A lot of Democratic challengers outraising Republican incumbents, which is almost unheard of.
Extraordinary. And doing it in a way that actually is encouraging, you know, not by subjugating themselves to special interests, but raising it in individual donations from small donors in their districts and around the country. So all those things are on the upside.
So with Republicans trying to keep the House, again, from a tactical standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, what is the smartest thing you have seen Republicans do in this cycle?
Well, I think we have to be honest about, I have really, really deep concerns about this president. I've been outspoken about those, and I'll continue to be. But I also recognize that he has an innate genius for rallying his base, some of it through this incitement that we've talked about. I thought one of the most interesting hinge moments in this race has been around the Kavanaugh hearings. Midday after Dr. Ford testified, it looked like a disaster for Republicans, and they made a decision, and I think it was a decision the president was involved in, and McConnell and others, that they were going to go tribal on the thing. And by the afternoon, you know, that's when they start talking about, you know, Democratic mobs, Democratic tactics, and making it a test of sort of party loyalty rather than and trying to navigate around her until the president didn't. So, you know, they needed to light a tribal fire. What happens in midterm elections often is that the party in power become the voters of the party in power become complacent. And I think the president, through, you know, by blowing out that issue in ways that I think were unfortunate, by, you know, this caravan arrived at just the perfect time for him, because immigration is a hot button issue for his voters. So, you know, I think that's why, as we sit here today, they're sending troops to the border. They're doing everything they can.
So here we are on the eve of the elections, put you on the spot. You feel as though the Senate is probably out of reach. But at this point, you look into your crystal ball. Do Democrats take back the House? And if so, by what margin?
I think Democrats will take the House back. I've always thought that the 30 seats would be a good showing. You know, on the average, a party out of power wins 32 seats. Given everything, all of the sort of structural obstacles because of redistricting, I felt like 30 seats would be an accomplishment. I still think they're going to land in that zone, and I don't think it's likely to go much higher. It could go a few seats lower, but I think the 23 is very attainable, and I think the likelihood is that Democrats take the House. You know, I think the Senate, I've said from the beginning that if Democrats could hold the margin at 51-49, given the historic obstacles they face, that would be an accomplishment. It may be that Republicans add a seat or two. I think there are a couple of other storylines I'd watch on election night. One is governorships. I think Democrats are going to take, you know, a significant number of state houses, which is not inconsequential going into both a presidential election and a redistricting.
And the remapping in 20, yeah.
So, you know, you look at states from including Florida, and then a crescent from Kansas to Iowa, across the Midwest, all the way to Pennsylvania. And I think Democrats are going to make some significant gains in governorships. And the last part of that storyline is, when you consider the states that delivered the presidency to Trump, Florida, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, you've got incumbent Democratic senators up in all of those states. I think it's more likely than not that every one of those senators is going to be reelected, and that you're going to see governorships shift in several of those states. That should be a sobering result for the White House and for Republicans, and has some augurings for 2020.
So there are two big questions looming, and they're interconnected if, in fact, Democrats take back the House. I think the first pertains to this issue of overreach and the danger of Democratic overreach if they control the lower chamber. And I think the second pertains to who is the leader of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Take the second part first, David. If Democrats were to win 30 seats or 32 seats, they have a relatively tight margin,
yeah,
of, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10
yeah.
House seats to play with. And you've got any number of Democrats running across the country having said publicly that they will not vote for Pelosi.
Right.
But the feeling in Washington is that, well, they can vote against Pelosi in a private conference vote. Yeah. But then once it comes to the floor, they can turn around and say justifiably, well, you know, this was the will of the caucus and we're going to vote for her. Ultimately, when the dust settles, if Democrats take back the House, do you see Pelosi coming back as Speaker?
There's no doubt what you say is true, and a third of the members voted against her or so last time. You know, I have to say, I worked with Nancy Pelosi when I was in the White House. Much of what was accomplished would not have been accomplished without her, because she is a tough, canny, effective leader of the caucus. And I remember I had her on my podcast, and I asked her what she learned growing up in, as the daughter of the mayor of Baltimore. Her brother was the mayor as well. And she said, I learned how to count. So, you know, I think she'll have a strong sense of where she is. And I would never bet against her in an internal vote. I also don't think that Democrat members are going to deliver the leadership of the House to the Republican Party. That said, I think it's not entirely clear what's going to happen. One thing I would say is that there's no doubt that if Pelosi survives, that she's going to have to make accommodations to these younger members who are restive. You know, you've got three leaders who are all in their upper 70s, and there's a restlessness, a restiveness among members to shake up the dynamic there and to advance some of the younger members. And I expect she, being as savvy a student of all of this as she is and a practitioner, that she'll have to find some way to, and will find some way to accommodate them if she survives.
And what about this question of overreach, David? I remember John Boehner's former chief of staff, Mike Summers, had said something to me years ago that always stuck with me, which was that oftentimes the worst thing that can happen to a party is taking the majority before you're ready to be a majority party. And he felt that that's what happened to them in 2010, that they came in, Bush was only 2 years removed from office, the party was not organized around anything other than just opposition to Obama, and that when they took back the majority, they spent those first years in the majority really overplaying their hand, and they ultimately probably helped President Obama get reelected because of it. Do you see any similar danger for Democrats if they take back the House, whether it's talk of impeachment, whether it's overreaching with their oversight? What is the, you know, how do they thread that needle, and what is the level of concern you would have?
Well, look, I was, you know, there was a talk of impeachment almost immediately after Trump got elected. I've been opposed to that. Here's my concern. Every norm that you break, every political norm that you break, process norm that you break, it's very hard to return, put that genie back in the bottle. And my argument was that impeachment can't be a political tool, even though, you know, it is to some degree, but it hasn't been invoked very often, and it ought to be on, you know, solid grounds. And there's a probe going on that, you know, will yield some information and judgments, and people ought to act on the basis of that. And there may be other issues as well, but the danger is that you, and Trump has set it up this way, he's tried to create a sense among his own base that if Mueller comes up with a negative result, that it's a purely political thing. I have to tell you, Bob Mueller was the FBI director when I was in the White House. I was in a couple of meetings with him when he came to the president to report on a shooting, a Fort Hood shooting or some other I never said a word in those, frankly, because he scared the shit out of me. but he was, I mean, he's the portrait of rectitude. And I've told Democrats, look, if Bob Mueller comes back and says there's nothing there, then I'm willing to say I believe that, because I know that he'll have been thorough in his investigation. But if he comes back with something that is damning, then I think Democrats have an obligation to act. And likewise, I think that, you know, this the complete absence of oversight in the first 2 years of the Trump administration has been a dereliction on the part of Republicans. They simply won't do it. I mean, we've seen that with Devin Nunes and others. I mean, you can only imagine, Tim, if some of the things that have gone on in the first 2 years had gone on in the Obama administration, they would be in a frenzy. And instead, they've turned the other way because they're afraid to
poke the bear.
Right. And tamper with the base that he commands. So I think that oversight is necessary. It's part of the job of Congress. And there are things, egregious things that are happening that need to be looked into. But in each and every case, it ought to be done on the premise of sound evidence and not just for malicious purposes of malicious mischief like the sort we saw under the Obama administration when the Republicans took control of the Congress. And because I think that the real danger for the country is the sense of a kind of bloodless coup, or that the system isn't legitimate and so on. As people who believe in government and the importance of a government, Democrats need to proceed in a way that is respectful of the process, even if the president is not.
And I think the sense is, obviously, David, that, you know,
that will, by the way, draw a lot of hoots and hollers from my own friends.
But you're used to it.
Yes, I'm getting there.
So I think, look, if regardless of if Democrats have a great night or if Republicans do better than expected, you're looking at no larger than probably a 7 to 10 seat majority for either party, which renders the next 2 years, legislatively speaking, somewhat meaningless. You're probably not looking at any major legislative accomplishments for the Republican Party in those 2 years. So aside from some of the chaos that we're discussing potentially taking place in Washington, so much of the attention politically will be on the 2020 reelect and on the emerging Democratic field and the 500 people who decide that they want to throw their hat in the ring and take on President Trump.
It's just 500.
Am I setting the over-under?
As we're sitting here, that number could be growing. I don't know.
And it's very possible that he has maxed that base out. I mean, I think for all the talk, you were referencing the Midwest earlier, for all the talk of how Trump may have, you know, realigned the electorate and redrawn the electoral map in some sort of a durable way, the fact is that Mitt Romney won more votes in Wisconsin in 2012 than Trump did in 2016.
Yeah.
So if the Democratic base is mobilized, and we're certainly seeing that in this election cycle, then you would have to think that, at least academically, the president would need to do something to expand upon his existing coalition if he's going to be reelected.
You would think so. You would think so. You know, it's always, you're always tenuous in betting on things relative to Trump because he's so audacious that you just don't know. But yes, I mean, I think that he, you know, pulled an inside straight in 2016, and he hasn't done that much to change his cards. So he may have to pull another inside straight. And when you look at how competitive the races are in the states in which he won the election and how Democrats, you know, we'll see. We could be sitting here on November 7th having a different conversation. But if Democrats, if the results are what they look to be, I think it's an important harbinger for him that Republicans just didn't do or well in those states that deliver the presidency to him.
So I want to talk about 2020, obviously, and from a Democratic perspective, how you can defeat Donald Trump. Let me clear the air first as a conflict of interest issue. Could you see yourself working for any of these prospective 2020 candidates? Are you informally advising anyone that we should know about?
Well, people come to me for advice all the time. I think I've talked to, you know, a dozen people who are running for president. And I talk to, you know, Republicans come under the dark of night and talk to me as well. But I'm not, look, I said when the 2012 campaign was over that That was my last campaign. I run the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. It is a joy, and it's a thing that keeps me hopeful every day. I have my duties at CNN, I have my podcast, and that's what I expect I'll be doing throughout 2020. I have no, I can see no set of circumstances under which I'd be working for any candidate, so consider the air clear.
And you were already at the top of the mountain twice.
Yeah.
And
the guy who was a friend in whom I had enormous, for whom I had enormous respect, it was as close to a perfect situation as one could have in politics. And one of the reasons that I stopped, that I said that would be my last campaign, is that I couldn't imagine another that would equal the experience that I had. And I didn't want to do it and be, you know, constantly frustrated and disappointed that whomever I was working for wasn't Barack Obama, and I didn't have that same kind of relationship.
I think this is the question that a lot of folks have when they look at this next crop of Democratic politicians. Are there people you look at and in whom you see that same flicker, that same raw political potential that could be harnessed in the way that you saw it in Obama all those years ago?
Look, that's unfair. You know, that's like saying, well, which of these horses reminds you of Secretariat? You know, it just isn't, there's not, people should forget about that. You know, there's not going to be a Barack Obama every 4 years. But there are talented people out there, you know, and formidable people. You know, they're the obvious. I mean, the vice president's out there, very seasoned, very talented. But, you know, then there are people who are less less known, who, you know, I spent an hour for my TV show with Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans. He has, and I knew him from years ago because I worked with his sister Mary on one of her races in Louisiana, and I came away from that meeting, I came away from that project thinking, boy, this guy Mitch, who was a young state rep at the time, has a lot of, he has political chops that are really prodigious. And we saw that when he spoke to the removal of the monuments in New Orleans. So I mean, you know, he's a very talented person. You know, it's been written, and it's no secret that Deval Patrick was a client of mine. He's a friend of mine. And I saw him in Massachusetts go from an asterisk to kind of storm the Democratic field when he got elected governor of Massachusetts. And he has formidable skills that I don't think people recognize because they haven't observed him as closely as I have. But if he were to spend a year in Iowa, I suspect he'd make a lot of friends there, as he did in Massachusetts. And then, you know, you have this bevy of senators. But I will say this. I think more than ever, this campaign is important because the campaign is a proving ground, and we'll find out very quickly, like who rises and who falls. You know, I often say campaigns for president are like pole vaulting, and you know, a lot of people clear the first bar, and then the bar gets raised, and you lose a few, and then, and I think that's what's going to happen here, and we'll see who can clear the heights. And someone, you know, we're not thinking about may emerge here. You know, but I do think people will be looking for, I don't think people will be looking for a Democratic version of Trump. I don't think they'll be looking for people who can go jibe for jibe and low blow for low blow. I think people are going to be looking for someone who can pull this country out of this hothouse that we're in, and this just got, you know.
So Michael Avenatti is not your personal choice for the Democratic nomination?
No. I know Avenatti. I've met him in green rooms, and we've had conversations and so on. So, but I disagree with him. I don't think that, and I disagree with my friend Eric Holder when he said, when we go high, when they go low, we kick them. I think we should challenge them, but I think the country's not looking for a continuation of the rancor that we've seen, that with Trump every single day. I mean, and, you know, there are a lot of people who voted for Trump, or a significant number of people who voted for Trump for because they didn't like Hillary Clinton, because they think they thought Washington needed a kick in the ass and that he could deliver that. But it's also true that he's exhausting. I mean, this constant state of churning and combat and insults and so on, they're exhausting. So I think one mistake the Democrats should not make is to just to kind of, in combating Trump, to assume that everybody who voted for him should be disqualified as well. There are people who voted for him. They may have made the wrong choice from my point of view or somebody else's point of view, but they think I made the wrong choice as well, who voted for him not because they particularly loved him, but because they wanted change. And I think those people have been exposed to it now. I think they'd be open to that change. But if it doesn't look like change, if it looks like more rancor, more low blow politics, more kind of opportunistic exploitation of people's grievances, then I think it improves his chances.
So what you're saying, and this is very interesting, that a Democrat in 2020 should not just be looking at this as a base mobilization campaign, but that there should be some persuasion involved.
I believe that. And this is a big debate, and I understand the debate. I understand the debate, you know, because the demographics are such that, you know, they would argue that if Hillary Clinton had just mobilized, for example, African-American voters in
Wayne County, Michigan,
right, yeah, or Milwaukee, mm-hmm, that he would have won. She would have won those states. I think that the two are not mutually exclusive. First of all, I think Donald Trump is going to mobilize base voters all by himself. I don't think you need to gild the lily. I don't think you need to help that process along. But there are voters who are going to be important in some of these swing states who are open to voting for a Democrat, but aren't necessarily eager to continue this kind of poisonous politics that we've seen. And they need to be given something more. I also think that one of the great deficiencies of the election of 2016 is that we never actually talked about the fundamental challenge that we have, which is that technology is churning so rapidly that it's created a great opportunity for those people who are well positioned to take advantage of it and disrupted a lot of lives for everyone else. The fact that wages have been flat over a long period of time is meaningful. And, you know, it's great. We just had an event at the Institute of Politics last night with Hank Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, and Chris Dodd. And Paulson said, you know, it's great that the economy is growing at 4%, but if wages aren't growing and if people don't feel like they're part of this this surge of economic activity and haven't for a long time, then they're going to lose faith not just in the economy and not just in our economic system, but also in our political system. So what do we do? What are the big things that we can do to deal with this rapid change? How do we get control of our future? Donald Trump was looking back to 1950, and Hillary had a bunch of laudable ideas, but that was never the central thesis of her campaign.
Well, it was the same in the Republican primary. You had Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, whose campaigns were built around pretty detailed policy proposals.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the lessons of all those campaigns is you can have 200 trees, but if you can't describe the forest in a way people get in a visceral way, that's just so much, future paper liners and bird cages.
And this is the cautionary tale for whoever winds up taking on Trump.
Yes.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
I want to go back to the Obama comparisons just for a moment, David, because arguably the highest profile campaign in this cycle is the Texas Senate race.
Yeah.
And you've had any number of comparisons and lots of talk in the last few months of Beto O'Rourke, Beto mania down in Texas, and the narrative taking hold very quickly that if he were to lose, that he would still be positioned as a top tier presidential candidate in 2020. I'm wondering from your perspective.
He says he's not going to run.
Well, so did Obama. Right? Yeah. Went on Meet the Press famously and said he wasn't going to run. How difficult is it, in your view, to come off of a losing campaign and yet still launch into a viable campaign for the presidency?
You know, I don't know, because he has a national following among young people. I sat with a group of young people the other day, really, really well-connected, smart young people, who said, well, if he comes close, he's got to turn around and run for president. I mean, he has touched a lot of people. So I'm sure there will be a lot of pressure on him to think about it if, in fact, that race is close in Texas. If he gets blown out, I think it's much harder. But he's raised a prodigious amount of money.
$38 million in one quarter.
Right. I mean, that's presidential level fundraising. And, you know, what's interesting, Tim, to me, and I think is instructive, is that's a difficult state. And he's gone into every county in that state. His message is very much, you know, the policy stuff is important. And he, you know, he's definitely staked out positions on the left. But I think the reason people are responding to him has more to do with character, more to do with the positive nature of his presentation, a sense of inclusiveness. You know, he seems to be genuine and authentic in the way he answers these questions. So, you know, he is not playing base politics, you know, despite the fact that he has inspired the base. He is speaking to something bigger than that. And he is, you know, and much as in 2004, when Obama ran for the Senate here, I was involved in that race. He seemed like an antidote. There was no doubt the war and some other issues animated his candidacy. But more than that, it was this notion that, hey, we could actually come together as a country. We don't have to be red states and blue states. We don't have to be at each other's throats. And here's a guy, an African-American from Chicago, who relates well to people across a very diverse state, who's, you know, campaigning vigorously in rural areas. And he represents a better kind of politics. I think Beto has, in that sense, touched a very important chord.
Let's talk about another progressive hero, Elizabeth Warren, and obviously has been in the news quite a bit recently with the release of the DNA findings. What do you make of that? And obviously, a lot of Democrats scratching their head, wondering what, if anything, was to be gained by doing that.
Yeah, let me say that of all the people who are running that I can see from my perspective, and I don't have visibility into everything everybody is doing, there isn't anybody who had done more to position themselves for 2020 than she had up to that point. You know, I've talked to a bunch of candidates who say, you wouldn't believe who called me on election night. Like, the first call I got was from Elizabeth Warren, winners and losers. She has a full staff going to service 2018 candidates and provide assistance in whatever way they need it. That's shrewd. She's laid out some policy positions that on reform, for example, that are shrewd positions, important positions. So, you know, I've been impressed by that. That was a head scratcher. I mean, it was a gamble. First of all, the timing of it was odd. Why, you know, intrude on this midterm process that way? Secondly, you know, it was instructive for everyone. You know, it's hard to get the upper hand with Trump in a kind of skunk fight. And, you know, I think she was trying to push back because she didn't want to have him, you know, continue on what is another version of like birtherism. and she thought she could end that discussion. But what she mostly did was elevate the issue, and that was the gamble. And I would say they lost that gamble. I don't think she actually, for those people who thought this was an issue, I don't think she necessarily allayed their concerns, but she did raise the salience of the issue. And, you take gambles in politics on this one, I think she probably lost.
So we've talked about the progressives, David. As we move towards closure here, I'm interested to know, we've talked before about how the Republican Party has moved right quickly in a pretty short window of time, and I've written ad nauseum about that over the last 10 years. If you look at the Democratic Party of 2008 and the Obama presidency and where the party was on cultural issues, still many Democrats who were opposed to same-sex marriage at that time, when they started working on the Affordable Care Act, single-payer didn't have a seat at the table. Obviously, lots of deportations in the first term of the Obama presidency, and he came under fire from the left. It seems as though the Democratic Party is shifting quite a bit itself. And there is a question of, is there room in the 2020 nominating fight for a centrist Democrat? And specifically, is there room for a white male, as the party seems to have been taken much more interest, if not in ideology, than in identity? If you look at some of the most successful candidates in this cycle, they have been women. They have been minority candidates who have been able to mobilize the base behind them. Is there room for a centrist Democrat, especially a white male?
I don't know, Tim. I certainly have seen the things that you've seen, but I think there also is a hunger for a candidate who behind whom everyone can march, but also who can, beat the president. I think those things are all going to be in the mix. And that's why I say, the campaign is going to be important. I mean, I think people are still waiting to see who captures their imagination. And I don't think it's limited just to women and minorities. I think that a candidate who has a kind of overarching vision and inspires people and a toughness to take on Trump, but in the right way, is going to be nominated. And that could be a woman, and it could be a man, it could be a minority, and it could be I don't subscribe to this notion that has been advanced by some. And I've heard it, from people I respect, that you can't beat Trump unless you nominate a white man, because he'll just exploit all of these divides as he has, and so on. I think it really depends on the candidate and how the candidate comports themselves. And if you have a candidate, white, black, male, female, who has the ability to reach out to a larger number of people, who shows the capacity to listen and understand what's going on in this country and the alienation that is out there, and address it and offer a way forward, I think that candidate is going to succeed. And I'm not willing to say that they come in any specific set of demographic qualities. I think that the quality of their message and their ability to inspire people is going to make the difference.
So you are a renowned Democratic wise man, and inherent to that specifically is your ability to understand message and image. And obviously that was what you helped spearhead in the Obama 08, Obama 12 campaigns. One of the smartest things I heard from you this cycle was when you were talking about Cory Booker, and you described him as this very smart, very talented guy, but that who maybe needs to take a few miles per hour off of his fastball, maybe tries a little bit too hard. So I want to close by doing a quick lightning round here, if you can.
People get struck by lightning. I'm not sure I like that.
Well, this will be relatively harmless, and I think we'll have some fun with it. But I want to name off a couple of 2020 potential 2020 Democratic presidential candidates. And I'd like you, in as concise a turn of phrase as possible, to describe...
That's not my thing, you can see.
Well, no, you've been doing pretty well, I would say. their greatest strength and their greatest vulnerability, a la Cory Booker. So, Kamala Harris.
Well, I mean, she's very, very bright. I think she makes a really great presentation. Her disadvantages, she can be cautious. And she comes from California, which is not a great training ground for presidential candidates because you never really have to meet a voter. It's just too big a state, so it's all TV. And you don't really have a genuine general election. So, you know, adjusting to a national context is going to be hard for her. And she's briefly on the national scene, but she's promising.
Bernie Sanders.
Well, Bernie is what Bernie is. I mean, his strength is that he's been saying the same thing for 50 years. He's utterly authentic. He's fearless. The downside is that he's been saying the same thing for 50 years, that he's been around 50 years to say the same things, and that he can be a little brittle and unyielding. But he is kind of a remarkable figure in our politics.
Julian Castro.
Yeah, Julian Castro is someone I know. He's been on the board of my, full disclosure, on the board of my Institute of Politics. I like him a lot. He is smart. He is earnest, very thoughtful, and, you know, a fresh face. Obviously, he is Hispanic, and he has a base potentially among those voters, but not limited to it. The downside is he's run for mayor of San Antonio. He's been in the cabinet, but never been exposed to the national scene in the way he would. Well, I'll leave it there, but I think highly of him.
A dark horse for me, Amy Klobuchar.
She's also very, very bright. She can be more nuanced than some of the candidates. I mean, she knows, she has a range, you know, so she doesn't get to 11 on a scale of 10 on every issue, but is thoughtful about them. And she's got a great sense of humor, which is useful. And she's from Minnesota, which borders on Iowa, which is, I think, very helpful. The downside is she hasn't made herself as well known as some of the other of her Senate colleagues. Sometimes being more vituperative is also a benefit at least in the short run in terms of raising money online and doing those kinds of things. And it's true of Castro as well. Is she too low-key? But certainly someone to watch.
We'll stay in the Midwest. Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah. Also a friend of mine. So more full disclosure. And look, I know all these folks and like them. But look, Pete's a remarkable guy. Incredible story. You know, elected mayor of South Bend at 27. Went to Afghanistan while he was mayor to do a tour of duty because he was in the reserves. Came back. He disclosed to his constituents that he's gay, and in South Bend, Indiana, home of Notre Dame, and in the center of the Rust Belt, got 80% of the vote in his reelect. And as mayor, has had a real vision for how you rebuild an economy in the digital age in a Rust Belt city. So he's been attracting tech and so on. So, you know, he's got a lot of upside. I thought he would be a great chairman of the Democratic Party when he ran for that. The downside is he's in his 30s and he's not at all well known raising the money because that's an issue. I mean, I think it's going to take $100 to $150 million to get through the first four contests and beyond in this cycle. And so that would be challenging for him. But he's one of the most promising young leaders in the Democratic Party.
And a final one here, Kirsten Gillibrand.
She has an instinct for issues that motivate. And on the whole Me Too issue, I mean, she's been very much identified with it, and both in terms of the dealing with assault on women within the military and on the issue more broadly. The downside of her is that there are some people who feel that she's been exploitative at times on that issue. And there's some rancor about, I think, among some Democrats about how she handled the Franken issue, and she'd have to deal with that.
Is there anyone we have not, Michael Avenatti aside, we have not talked about, well, any non-politicians?
Let me talk about Terry McAuliffe.
Sure.
First. I've talked to probably a dozen or more candidates. No one surprised me more on the upside with his presentation when he came to the university, to the Institute of Politics, when he did my podcast. And I forgot how sort of much he was the happy warrior on the balls of his feet. You've seen this. He is relentless. He is uncowed, and you know, he could probably strike a tone that would be interesting against Trump, you know, pairing him with kind of humor. And he's got a pretty good story to tell from Virginia. The downside is he's been so thoroughly identified with the Clinton Project for so long, and I don't know that that would be viewed as advantageous. And he is avowedly a centrist, and he would be testing that premise that the party is not going to nominate a white male centrist. You know, there are Governor Hickenlooper from Colorado. He's an interesting guy. He's a quirky communicator, and whether he can conform to an environment in which one has to express oneself more pithily than I am right now, for example, I don't know, but he's an interesting guy. There are other, Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, has talked about running. Steve Bullock appears to be running, the governor mm-hmm. of Montana.
The lightning round could turn into an all-consuming podcast on its own.
But I mean, Hickenlooper is someone I think should be, not dismissed. And then there are the outsiders. You know, the Howard Schultzes, for example. We haven't talked about Mike Bloomberg. You know, people can bring great resources to this, who are.
Or Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook.
Right. I mean, so I think this is a wide open situation. I do think the one thing I would say is Donald Trump, you know, everybody says, well, Donald Trump could run and he was never in politics. But Donald Trump was always in the public eye. He was, you know, he grew up in the New York press environment. He kind of thrived on it. He knew how to play the game. And he had 14 years as a television star. And so he understood how to handle the whole celebrity aspect of this. And he was completely comfortable in the maelstrom that is contemporary politics, not just comfortable, but he was comfortable stirring the pot every day. For these people who've never run before, who run in small venues, that's going to be an adjustment.
And I made that fleeting reference to Joe Biden, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you after mentioning all those names. What does your gut tell you? Do you think he runs?
He sure seems to be headed in that direction. You know, I think two things. One is, I think he's genuinely offended by the way Trump is governing and not governing, the way he's dividing the country. That seems clear. It's also true that, this is a guy who's been talked about as a presidential nominee, you know, since the time he arrived in the Senate in 1973. He's run twice before. He knows the job as well as anybody. He really was an important counselor to President Obama, and he had 35 whatever number of years in the Senate, and so it's hard to say, no, I don't think so. I'm going to pass on this one. I think he feels he would have won last time if he had been the nominee, and so I think there are a lot of things that are pulling him in that direction. There may be personal things that are pulling him in the other. I thought it was interesting that he said that he's openly engaged on the age question, which is clearly going to be an issue for several of these people mm-hmm. Who are in their late 70s. And he said, yeah, that's a legitimate issue. And so one of the things that he'd have to do if he ran is run in such a way that the vigor of the campaign was evident. And so that's a commitment. And the question is, whether at the end of the day he wants to make it. But right now, I would guess he's running.
So, David Axelrod, you have been very generous with your time to get you out of here on this. We joked about the over-under of 50 candidates in the field. But in all seriousness, how many do you think, Celinda Lake had joked a few months ago when I was speaking with her that she could very easily see 35. And that might sound outlandish to some people, but realistically, how many candidates do you think jump in or at least launch an exploratory committee?
Well, I think, probably upwards of 20. I don't know how much upwards. I think there are people who will, and we'll know very quickly because the race will begin, all you weary voters, on November 7th. So don't fret if you miss. If you think you're going to miss politics, you'll have a plenty. But I think what people are going to have to find out is how is the support and resources there to sustain a race like that. And they're going to confront the reality of what running for president in 2020 will be. And I think the field will be weeded out, but it's still going to be very large. That large Republican stage in 2016 is going to be the large Democratic stage in 2020. And it's going to be, as it always is, the early states that will weed the field down. And then we'll see who the finalists are.
David Axelrod, the smartest man in Democratic politics, an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you so much.
You said everybody had that. Great to be with you.
Only the really smart ones. Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
That's all for this week's Off Message. What did you think? If you're a Democrat especially, what did you make of Axelrod's handicapping of the 2020 field? And moreover, what do you make of his argument for civility and his assertion that Democrats won't be looking for their own version of Trump to run against him? As always, please continue to send me your thoughts, questions, comments, and criticisms at talberta@politico.com. Thank you to our producer, Zach Stanton, our executive producer, Dave Shaw, and a special thank you to Olivia Richardson for helping us out with recording in Chicago. If you like Off Message and if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It really does help us find new listeners for the show. Thanks so much for tuning in, and before you go, I want you to know there's a special programming note. We will not be back with Off Message next Tuesday because it's Election Day. We will, however, be recording the next day, Wednesday, with a special post-election episode of Off Message featuring some very special guests giving you unique and exclusive insights into what went down on Election Day. So please make sure to come back and see us next week.